Tonight on Arena, editor James West on how The Great Gatsby has been misunderstood and underestimated, and the Ingmar Bergman season at the Irish Film Institute. +51551 is the text. You can get us on socials at RTE Arena. Who said The Great Gatsby was about the best American novel ever written? F. Scott Fitzgerald said that. Now, self-praise, maybe no praise, but for many, he was correct when he made that declaration. The book was first published in 1925, set against the backdrop of the Roaring Twenties. It has in its crosshairs the very concept of the American dream of wealth and prosperity for all. Scott Fitzgerald began writing it when he was just 28 years old. The story is narrated by Nick Carraway, a man in awe of his new, fantastically wealthy Long Island neighbour, Jay Gatsby, who is still in love with Daisy Buchanan, who is married to another man. Now, 100 years after the book was first published, the novel is a bona fide classic. Not only that, the title has transcended the confines of literature. Just saying the word Gatsby evokes a very specific mood, style and era. To mark The Great Gatsby's anniversary, Cambridge University Press has published a special centenary edition. It's edited by James L.W. West. But before we speak to James, let's remind ourselves of that very specific mood created by Scott Fitzgerald in his novel, with a clip from Baz Luhrmann's 2013 film adaptation. In this scene, Nick Carraway, who is searching for Gatsby at one of his legendary parties, is talking to a friendly stranger.
She's mine.
Your face is familiar. Weren't you in the 3rd Division during the war?
Come to that!
Oh, yes, the 9th Battalion.
I was in the 7th.
Excuse me. I knew you looked familiar. Having a good time, old sport.
Oh, the whole thing's incredible. I live just next door. He sent me an actual invitation. Seems I'm the only one. I still haven't met Mr. Gatsby.
No one's met him. They say he's 3rd cousin to the Kaiser and 2nd cousin to the devil.
I'm afraid I haven't been a very good host, old sport.
You see, I'm Gatsby.
His smile was one of those rare smiles that you may come across 4 or 5 times in life. It seemed to understand you and believe in you just as you would like to be understood and believed in.
Sorry, old sport, I thought you knew.
Leonardo DiCaprio there, DiCaprio as Gatsby, Tobey Maguire as Nick Carraway in Baz Luhrmann's screen adaptation of The Great Gatsby. I'm joined by the editor of the new centennial edition of the novel, James L.W. West. I could almost feel you, James, wincing when I said, one, The Roaring Twenties, two, The American Dream, and then I played a clip from a film version of the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. These are the very things that I think in this centennial edition you're trying to get us to think again about.
Well, I liked Baz Luhrmann's film adaptation, and I don't mind talking about the American dream or about the fact that The Great Gatsby seems to have become the emblematic American novel. At least you didn't bring up the green light. I taught The Great Gatsby for many years, and I finally had to ban all term papers on the green light. We all know what it means, but we just can't put it into words. There are things that we want to get past with this edition of The Great Gatsby. One of them is the idea that Fitzgerald simply tossed the novel off, that he wrote like the birds sing. In fact, he worked quite hard over a long period of time to get the novel just right.
Well, you're an absolute, you've worked right across the work of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and that accusation often levelled at Fitzgerald of all style, no substance is one of the, I'm sure, things that annoys you enormously about references to The Great Gatsby. However, was The Great Gatsby, explain where it comes in his work, and How much of a shift was it? Because he'd written, I think, four novels at this stage, possibly. But there were it was mostly short stories that he had published.
That's true. He had written two novels.
Two novels, sorry.
Yes, The Sound of Paradise and The Beautiful and Damned. But because of the way the literary marketplace was organized then, he made most of his income by writing entertaining stories for popular magazines, magazines called The Slicks, because they were printed on coated paper with color illustrations. Mm. The stories are wonderful, but they certainly don't give us much of a forecast of The Great Gatsby.
So when it came to The Great Gatsby, what do you think, at the age of 28, what was it that made him sit down and say, I'm going to spend a long time working on this novel till I get it as absolutely closest to the very best thing I can do? What do you think he was looking to achieve, apart from just that, the best thing he could possibly do? What was he, what themes, what ideas did he want to look into?
It was his ambition, his desire to be considered something more than a writer of popular short stories. And yet, he also wanted to sell a great many copies of The Great Gatsby and make a great deal of money. That's one thing about Fitzgerald. He balanced on that line between art and commerce, between popular entertainment and serious literature, about as well as any writer of his generation. And I think that quality remains in The Great Gatsby. It's fun to read. It's a good book.
Yeah, it's a good story. In fact, I'm constantly, and spoiler alert if you haven't read it, obviously, I'm constantly surprised with The Great Gatsby when you get to the end. The body count is actually quite high. There are jilted lovers, there are lovers who are jealous, there are all sorts of things going on in this particular suburb, which maybe isn't what you think, what people might think of. I think they'll think of flappers and they'll think of the Charleston, a dance, I believe, that isn't even mentioned in the novel.
That's true. The Charleston had not emerged yet. In The Great Gatsby, they're doing the shimmy, which was an earlier dance craze, or the bunny hug, or the kangaroo hop. And these were the dance crazes of the time. And as Sarah Churchwell points out in her introduction to the novel,
yes,
women were not wearing short skirts at all. They were wearing long skirts. That was the fashion of the times. So we try to make all of that clear. We have a section of color illustrations showing what people were wearing and the kinds of cars they were driving, and some of the movie stars and cabaret stars of that period, the sheet music for the songs that are sung in the novel. The novel is peppered with references to popular culture of that time. And, of course, 100 years have passed, and so Fitzgerald's readers back then would have known exactly what he was talking about, but we don't today. So in this edition, we're giving modern readers some help.
And, I mean, a really great novel, a classic novel, is always going to have a contemporary resonance for any reader who picks it up at any point in time, and probably for any reader who picked it, The Great Gatsby, up in the past century. It has had certain resonances. What resonances does it have for you in the particular moment we're in now?
The Great Gatsby seems endlessly adaptable to the current moment. Certainly with what's going on over here with the rise of the oligarchy, with the new administration, with the glitter and glamour, if you want to call it that, of the current moment in Washington, D.C., The novel seems very current, but in other ways, the lessons that the novel teaches about status, and particularly about money, the authority of money, these seem never to grow old. I often tell my students that readers in the UK understand status. They understand the class system in a way that we really don't over here. We all think we're middle class. But we understand money.
Yeah.
We think about money in America, what it buys, what it doesn't buy, and what its particular authority is to influence human behavior. All of those lessons are taught in The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, I guess middle class, yes, may well be pretty much, might define much of American society, but there are middle class billionaires and middle class people who are struggling to get from one paycheck to the next, and people below that as well who are struggling to get from now till the next 10 minutes or next hour. However, one of the things, and you don't shy away from this either yourself or Sarah in the in this new edition of The Great Gatsby, James, is the references to language and the nature of language and how what F. Scott Fitzgerald was doing, that if you don't read the novel, if you just see a film version of it, you don't hear that language or see that language or read that language in the same way.
You're exactly right.
Yes, well, maybe expand a bit more and give me examples of some of the language and how it does that, James. We seem to have lost James there, I think. Sadly, we can't get James Elwes. Something has happened with the line. But he was talking to us about the Cambridge Centennial edition of The Great Gatsby, which is published by Cambridge University Press. British photographer Samara Pierce is bringing a deeply personal story to the Dingle Film Festival with her documentary Family Album. The film explores the life and legacy of her great-grandfather, Austrian engineer Alexander Weinberger, who risked his life to document the horrors of the Holodomor, the man-made famine that devastated Ukraine in 1933. In Family Album, Pierce retraces his steps, travelling to modern-day Ukraine during the ongoing war to capture her own photographs of the contemporary destruction and resilience of the Ukrainian people, and in the process drawing enormous parallels between that and what went on in 1933. I'm delighted to be joined this evening by Samara Pierce. Samara, this all started, in fact, with a camera that came to you via your grandfather stroke grandmother.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you for having me. Yes, in 2012, everything changed for me. My understanding of world history, certainly Ukrainian history, all because of a Leica that was passed on through my family.
And that Leica, I mean, the camera itself, it's a lovely, obviously an historical feel of it. It was from that period in time, the 1930s, and your great-grandfather had this interest in photography. But that in turn opened you up to what your great-grandfather had done with that camera.
Yes, my grandmother had tried discussing it further in the 80s. Obviously, the Russian government were not interested in any discussion to do with Holodomor at the time. Thankfully, in 2012, there was a little bit more warmth towards discussing Holodomor, although there was not a lot of information in English. But since 2012, thankfully, that has the information on Holodomor has exploded. So anybody that wants to go and research it in any language can find information.
Yeah, and one of the things I know that many people will have come across that term Holodomor from the Mr. Jones film starring James Norton, which is based on the true story of a Welsh journalist, Gareth Jones, who uncovers the devastating truth about Holodomor, in which millions died in Ukraine at the time. Explain what Holodomor was and what happened at the back in 1933, Samra.
Yes. So it was to do with the five-year plan of Stalin. He wanted to force the Ukrainian population into collectivization. Other communities as well did suffer, but Holodomor was predominantly Ukrainians that suffered. They fought back. They wanted independence. They wanted to be able to be free farmers. And this meant that implementing the 5 years of corn. So if you stole more than 5 years of corn, that you would potentially be put up for death penalty.
And extraordinary, like so many cases, it's a man-made famine. That's what we're talking about. I mean, we know about it in this country.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are very strong similarities between the two about the control of food and how to weaponize that to control people in the population.
However, go ahead, Samara.
I was going to say, it does mean that you have a much larger understanding and can help other people around the world understand what happens in these situations.
Now, the film is not called Family Camera. It's called Family Album. Let's have a listen to a clip that explains to a certain extent. You went off on a contemporary journey. Was it 2023 when you travelled to Ukraine and made some discoveries while there, as we'll hear in this clip from your film Family Album?
My great-grandfather was invited to work in Kharkiv as a qualified chemical engineer. There he was to run a plastic manufacturing plant. Alex came to Kharkiv and found himself in the epicenter of Holodomor.
I can't even tell you exactly how I came across Wiener Burger. Of course, I got interested, and then I came across some unique documents. He has bought about 600 photographs from the Soviet Union. And a lot of them dealt with the topic Holodomor. And it also turned out that those pictures are probably still the most important of all existing.
Alex risked his life in order to take these photos. However, the truth mattered more to him.
And that is a clip from Family Album, and writer, director and narrator of the film, Samara Pierce, is with me on the phone this evening. And the film has been shown at the Dingle Film Festival. Samara, what struck me as you went along was you're then presented with this album, which was kept safe. And it's an Austrian voice, if I remember right, that's telling us the story of the album and the documents in that particular clip from the film. It was kept safe by the magic, if that's not too glib a word, of your great-grandfather knowing to get the album and the documents out of Kharkiv at the time.
Yes. So not only did he manage, he got the film stills out potentially by diplomatic mail. And then after he returned himself to Austria, he did manage to escape the USSR. He managed to produce two printed albums, one which was given to Theodore Cardinal Anitza in Austria to keep safe. And the second he gave to his own daughter, who brought that album to England. So we have the red album and we have the grey album.
Yeah, and I think you maybe had seen the red album earlier in your life via your grandmother as well. What did you see in those photographs? And we're talking about 1933, just for the moment here. What did you see?
So some of the images that are less intrusive would be long lines of people waiting for bread. And then you go along to individuals who have perished, and you can see there is a fascination at the beginning of people losing their life through starvation. And then as it goes on, you see grave sites, which there are up to 250 people per burial site. And these mounds go on as far as the eye can see. There are children who have perished on the road where people are walking past paying no attention. As it progressed, people become desensitized to the suffering of others because they couldn't help.
And what I found extraordinary about the movie then is you're exploring this in 2023 in contemporary Ukraine during the contemporary war, and the parallels are frightening.
Yes, 100%. I believe that Putin has very much taken a Stalin stance towards the Ukrainian people. He fears the Ukrainian people, how strong they are, how strong their identity is. And he knows that starvation worked as a very good tool of reducing population and causing instability. The difference is this time is Ukraine has a voice. Ukraine has the ability to stand up. They have the ability to fight back. And that strength has made Ukraine even stronger and has done the opposite of everything Putin was trying to achieve, because everybody now knows where Ukraine is.
The other aspect that you have in the way you make the film, Samara, is sometimes, or a lot of the time, I think, the person who is voicing in English Ukrainian texts or Austrian texts that your grandfather may have written at the time, and contemporary Ukrainian descriptions being translated on stage, it's the same voice that's doing it. And that makes it even eerier, the parallels between 1933 and 2023.
Yes, I think it's very difficult as well to speak to certain people who had experienced both, to know that they had witnessed such atrocities as very young children, and then again at the end of their life, like bookends.
Yeah, you visit a very old woman in a very small village. I'm not sure of the exact location, but her descriptions are just harrowing.
Yes. And these ladies will sit there and they will laugh with you, and they will tell you still what a wonderful life they had in Ukraine, even with these atrocities either end and a couple of wars in the middle.
You also revisit with contemporary real people. I'm going to say characters, but they're real people. You visit them looking up at the ruins of the home in which they have lived in for 15, 20 years. And it's absolutely destroyed. In one case, we have a woman describing to us what happened on the very first morning of the Russian invasion, and how effectively the people in her apartment block, you just were lucky if you got out. Lots didn't. Yeah. And she was one of the lucky ones who did. The randomness of it, which seems to have been the case in 1933 as well.
Yes, you certainly have characters that managed to play quite a big role in making a society or their community safe and feel that they can get through something. This lady in particular that you're talking about, she happened to bring, there were 250 people in the basement where she was staying, where they couldn't leave. She happened to bring a bread maker with her, and she fed all 250 people with that bread maker, which is a very poignant story because of how important bread is from 1933 throughout history in Ukraine and to the present day, that she managed to do that without any planning. It just happened that she could do this for her community.
Yeah, and the most harrowing scenes within the film for me, many of them are one of your particular contributors describing, taking groups of bodies to a burial spot outside of his own small village and putting his own life in danger when doing it. I mean, at one point, I think he thought he was told to dig, and he thought, well, that's the end of me. I'm digging my own grave. It truly was frightening stuff. How frightening was it for you while you were there?
I've been to Ukraine quite a lot of times. I know Ukraine very well. I do not get worried by the air sirens or anything like that. To me, talking about what was happening and collecting these stories was the most important thing, and that kind of put everything else into the shadows. So I wasn't scared of being there. I felt that these people being able to relive these stories and tell me these stories was the bravest thing to do. And for me, I was just coming to collect these stories, to be able to relive something that you're still traumatized by, you're still living in to this day, I think is probably one of the strongest things that you can do. And that gentleman in particular, his story was absolutely amazing, that he had that strength.
And the emotional journey for you, I mean, some of what you had to see, I wouldn't care to be put in your position.
Yes, there, going through, there were days where you could laugh. You had these people who would tell you horrific stories, but they were so kind-hearted and they had such good humor, and they knew how to break that feeling of sadness. And then, yes, other days, certainly you were told that day in particular where we were dealing with the gravediggers, we then had to go on to talk about children who had unfortunately been captured by the Russian soldiers. And when you are faced, you try to block off the emotions when you're doing the story, but then obviously you think about these people afterwards, and they certainly, I think about them every day.
And you do, you certainly do talk or you certainly do document lots of the people who speak to you, and lots of the destroyed buildings and the burial grounds and, you know, crosses with nothing on them but numbers. How much did you use, because you are a photographer, how much did you use contemporary equipment, or was there something special when you used your great-grandfather's Leica, oftentimes in exactly the locations that he had taken his pictures back in his photographs back in 1933?
Yes, I never expected to be able to do that, and I'm very grateful to the team that managed to find those locations. It was a touching moment for me to have that connection. It felt like I was doing something right, like I was doing something for my family, and I was continuing that promise that my grandfather, my great-grandfather, made to the Ukrainian people that he would speak out, and that I had the chance to do that. So, it was an honour to be able to have that moment.
Obviously, the film is a screening on Saturday night, and it's part of a series of films, Common Ground, The Irish-Ukrainian Experience, which is at the Dingle Film Festival. Has there been a feeling with you, or an exploration within your the way you might present the film on Saturday night, about that Irish famine and the parallels, as you say, that are there?
Yes, definitely. I think it means that people will come in already having an understanding. They already understand the propaganda that come around that as well. And that connection is very strong. So I do hope that people can understand. And I'm very grateful to the North East West Kerry Development, the local company there that's managed to set this up for us to be able to present this film at the Dingle Distillery International Film Festival.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us and telling us about it tonight, Samara. That is Samara Pierce. Family album will be screened this Saturday at the Blasket Centre as part of Common Ground, the Irish-Ukrainian Experience, which is at the Dingle Distillery Film Festival. The screening will be introduced by Ukrainian Ambassador Larissa Garasco on the night, and followed by a discussion with Samara Pierce. Full details on dinglefilmfestival.com. It's almost two decades now since the death of Swedish filmmaker Ingmar Bergman, and a little over a century since his birth in 1918. His films have, however, endured, and some would say he is the begetter of Scandinavian war, given that one of the most iconic images from his films is Max von Sydow's Knight playing chess with death on the beach in The Seventh Seal. The Irish Film Institute season, Between Heaven and Hell, films of Ingmar Bergman, is a chance to look back at the work of the Swedish auteur, featuring films from The Seventh Seal, scenes from A Marriage to Persona, and Fanny and Alexander. Delighted to be joined by Jan Hollenberg, the director of the Ingmar Bergman Foundation in Sweden, who is coming to Dublin for this special event at the IFI. He's such a huge filmmaker, Jan. How would you describe that singular vision that was Bergman? Because we're talking about a man who was a writer and a theatre and filmmaker.
Right, yes. Well, that's a big one.
Easy question first.
Yeah. Well, I think that Ingmar Bergman's vision, in a word, or rather in several words, but I think it has to do with problems of communication. So whether his films are about families, both husbands and wives, rivalry between siblings, or relationship between parents and the children, or if it's about the role of the artist, as many in many of his films, or the theme of religion, which is prevalent, I think it all boils down to the problems of communication, whether it's with a silent God or with a father who's absent.
and two things of which may well be present in his Lutheran Protestant upbringing. How did that how did that shape the young Bergman?
Oh, it's. I mean, his father was a pastor, and I think that Bergman is. I mean, religion has shaped him in so many ways, and which is rather, it's an anomaly in Sweden, because I mean, when Bergman came to fame in the late 1940s and 50s in Sweden, Sweden had already, in a way, become probably the most secularized country in the world. Mm. And here was Bergman still struggling with questions of whether there is a God or not. And so I think that Bergman has always been seen by his fellow Swedes as something of an anomaly.
Yeah. I want to start with a clip which gives us a great sense of the humanity of the young child, Ingmar Bergman, because it mm-hmm. might well not have been him who was the filmmaker at all. It could have been his brother, as we'll hear in this wonderful story that Bergman himself tells.
Cinema, film, was to me an obsession. I don't know. I saw my first picture when I was 6 years old, and then I was completely lost. And what I wanted most of all, that was to have a projector of my own, you know, a small one, just a toy, children's toy, not very expensive. One Christmas, before Christmas, the Christmas presents were under the staircase, and I saw there was a brown package, and I knew this is the projector. And I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, and then Christmas came and my brother got the projector. And I was so disappointed, so I think I'm dying, I can't survive this. But we had both, my brother and I, tin soldiers. So I bought, on the day after Christmas Eve, I bought from my brother the projector and gave him my whole army.
I just love that story. That is Ingmar Bergman speaking to Melvin Bragg on the BBC about how he did a deal with his brother, in fact, on getting that first projector. And speaking with me this evening ahead of the IFI's upcoming season on Bergman's film Between Heaven and Hell is Jan Holmberg, who is the director of the Bergman Foundation in Sweden. So where did that love of film come from? Do we know? I mean, it was just straightforward sibling rivalry. We always think that our brothers or sisters' presents were better than ours.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, well, I think that, of course, Bergman was, as you said, he was born in 1918 when cinema had already been around for a while. And of course, in Bergman's childhood, cinema was the main pastime for most people, I suppose. Yeah. And so, so I sometimes think about, I mean, if Bergman had been born in a different decade, I'm sure that he would still be an artist of someone. He would probably be a playwright or a novelist, but he just happened to be born in a time mm-hmm. when cinema was, in a way, the main art form the art form to be, and so it was just.
It was the time, and he was
exactly,
there.
Exactly, yeah. I think it was more that than more than anything, because he would say himself that he was more a man of the theatre than he was of cinema.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because was there a theatrical background within the family? I mean, Strindberg, Ibsen wouldn't have been that far away from in terms of time, wouldn't have been that far away from the young Bergman.
Yeah, Strindberg died just a few years before Berman was born, so there is so as you say, it was not that long ago. But there was no tradition there were no artists in his family. But in a way, and I think Berman would agree, the fact that his father was a pastor was still, I mean, it's still a kind of a performance, right? And yeah. And it's still, forgive me, but you could think of it as a kind of a fiction or something. You tell stories, whether they're from the Bible, in the case of his father, or in the case of Berman, something that he makes up himself.
Yeah, but and often in that Lutheran tradition, the word of the Bible, which of course would have been in the vernacular of whatever country it is printed in, there was always a performative element to that. Certainly, I remember that particular faith. But that collaborative aspect to what he did seems to have been important. And obviously, film is a collaborative art, so is theatre pretty much. Let's hear him speaking about how important that aspect of his work was to him.
You know, sometimes there is a miracle happening in front of the camera. Sometimes, not very often, but sometimes. If you are very close to the actors and close to the people around the camera, and there is an atmosphere of confidence real confidence. It's suddenly something happens in front of the camera. That is the most beautiful thing that exists. And to wait for that miracle and to hope for it is the best thing in the world.
There we go. And that is, again, Ingmar Bergman speaking about this whole idea of collaboration. With me this evening is Jan Hollenberg, speaking about the upcoming season Between Heaven and Hell, the films of Ingmar Bergman, which will be showing at the IFI. Given that Lutheran background was there, as you have mentioned already, Jan, I'm wondering how much did that literary and that very much, I suppose, word, that verbal aspect of things feed into both his theatre and in particular his films?
It's absolutely immense, I think. I mean, for my money, I think Bergman is an even greater writer than he is a filmmaker. And I think it's absolutely crucial that he writes his own films. I think it has much to do about his upbringing and his background and the fact that, as you were saying, and specifically in the Protestant tradition, how important the word is. I think there are other filmmakers who are more visual than Berman. I mean, of course, notwithstanding all the iconic images, like you mentioned, Death playing chess with the knight in The Seventh Seal and others. But still, I think Bergman is a man of words rather than a man of images, if you like.
And how significant a film was The Seventh Seal at the time? Oftentimes with films like this, they don't make a mark, particularly in the initial moment. It takes time for them to be appreciated. Was Bergman's work appreciated quickly, The Seventh Seal in particular?
Oh, it was. Internationally, at least. Not so much in Sweden, but certainly abroad. And I think that Bergman, I mean, again, he was lucky. It came out in 1957, which was the same year when the notion of the auteur was launched by the Cahiers du Cinéma in France. And the world had, in a way, waited for filmmakers with a strong vision who could be seen as artists rather than as craftsmen or as just purveyors of entertainment. And so Bergman just tagged along with the likes of Fellini and Kurosawa and many others, but he was in many ways the epitome of this new idea of the filmmaker as an auteur, as an artist.
And of course, all artists' work is autobiographical. It could be ordered. It could be argued. But Bergman,
absolutely, yeah, that's actually something that Bergman often claims. So, yeah.
Even though he did draw in various films on aspects of his childhood, images from his childhood, buildings from his childhood, they were all there in films that he made.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Do you dismiss that idea then, that it's very autobiographical? You know,
not at all. I think it is, but it's a bit more complicated, I think, because there are things in Bergman's childhood that which he claims that have happened, but where other sources claim they haven't. His siblings, for instance. And so I think that certainly his life shaped his work, but I think it's also the other way around in a way, because his fiction or his films in a way shaped his how he not only how he claimed that his life had been, but also how he saw it himself, I think.
Yeah,
he believed that things had happened which they clearly haven't.
Yeah, and that's particularly true possibly in Fanny and Alexander, which is the one I was speaking about, which is in the town of Uppsala, Bergman's birthplace, and the whole debate between religion and theatre is in there as well. The fear and the thoughts around death was always something very important within his life. Let's have a listen to him speaking about that.
I'm very afraid of the most of things that exists in this world. And especially I was very afraid of death. And then I thought, I didn't think, I just made it. I wrote this Seventh Seal. And the Seventh Seal is about death the whole time in this picture. And everybody in this picture reacts differently to death. And after that picture, of course, I still think very much about death and but after that picture, it's not an obsession anymore. I just can't live with it. So that the picture was a good medicine.
Which, that there we are, Ingmar Bergman talking about the Seventh Seal and his fear of death. And Jan Holmberg is speaking with me this evening about the upcoming season of Bergman's film at the AFI. And that links in with what you were saying, that in fact, Jan, he worked out, or he explained to himself the fears, the ideas, the philosophies that he had through his work. Again, nothing new about that for an artist.
Exactly, Sean. Yeah, I think... it's the privilege of the artist, isn't it? I mean, to have his work as kind of a self-therapy. He certainly did.
One of the other films being shown at the AFI is from 1963, Winterlight. What aspect of Bergman's work do we see there?
Winterlight is the Swedish title is Nattvardsgästerna, which means the communicants, and so it's set in a small parish somewhere in the north of Sweden, and it's one of Bergman's most openly it's a film about the church or about a pastor, and I think it's one of my personal favorites, and I think it was very close to Bergman himself as well, because again, it's a way, in a way, I think it tells the story of his father, but also about his very ambivalent relationship with religion. That it spurred a huge debate in Sweden at the time, because the church felt that it had that it was blasphemic. But in a way, it's Bergman's most religious film.
Debating
it could be seen.
Yeah, debating something is not necessarily problematic. It's possibly a good thing. Jan, thanks for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you so much.
That's Jan Hollenberg, director of the Ingmar Bergman Foundation. And the Bergman season, Between Heaven and Hell, the films of Ingmar Bergman, runs at the IFI in Dublin from this Saturday, February the 1st, through until late March. Full details of the programming on ifi.ie. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Jamie Doyle was on sound tonight. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And Ray Cudahy will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.